Welcome to the Spectrum Policy Podcast, brought to you by Policy Tracker, which provides news, research, and training about spectrum management. WRC 23 is getting closer and closer. In the next 4 episodes of our podcast, we will cover the most discussed items, the hot potato topics of the conference. We'll be talking about science-related items, satellite, transport-related items, and of course, INT. My name is Laura Sear, and I'm a journalist at Policy Tracker. Today, we'll be talking about IMT-related issues at WRC. To talk about this, I've got Martin Fenton here with me. He's the Director of Spectrum Analysis at Ofcom and Chair of the ITUR Study Group 5. Hello, Martin. Welcome, and thanks for talking to me today.
My pleasure. We're glad to be here.
Martin, what exactly is your role in the ITU? What are the responsibilities of a chairman of a study group?
Well, as you said, I chair Study Group 5, which is the study group responsible for all terrestrial services. So that includes mobile, maritime, aeronautical, fixed, and IMT is one of those. As the chair of the group, I sort of responsible for obviously conducting the meetings of Study Group 5, which is there to support the work of the working party, so the subgroups of the study group. So there are working parties responsible for those different aspects of the work. They develop things like ITUR recommendations and reports that look at how spectrum should be used or how things might share, and the study group itself then approves those and they get published on the ITU website. The working parties are also responsible for all the work that goes into the preparation for the WRC. So they look at the agenda items that are relevant to their area of work, and they're responsible for doing the actual studies themselves. And that all comes under the auspices of the study group itself. Though, to be honest, the work they do in relation to the WRCs goes directly into a report called the CPM, the Conference Preparatory Meeting Report, and it doesn't filter through the study group itself. But I'm there to sort of help organise the work, support what they're doing, and obviously chair the meetings and hopefully corral consensus so that we can agree the outputs.
And does that involve you sitting in on several meetings and the preparatory meetings as well? Or do you lead these meetings of the study group?
I obviously lead the study group meetings themselves. So I'll be normally out in Geneva for those, though this study periods have been a bit different with COVID in the early part. A lot of the meetings transferred into online meetings rather than face to face, but the second half of the study period has been face to face, normally in Geneva. So I will go to the study group meetings to chair them. I will also go to some, but not all, of the working party meetings. They're held separately from the study group itself, and I will go and I will, you know, partake in those meetings as needed. And but I don't attend all of the working party meetings.
Yeah, there are quite a few under study group 5.
There's quite a lot. So there are 4 working parties. They each typically meet 2 to 3 times a year. The 3 of the working parties meet in what's called a block. So they go to Geneva at the same time and they meet the same time in the same location. The one on IMT tends to work separately from the other 3, so it has separate meetings at different times. So there's quite a lot of meetings, and they take quite a long time. So a typical working party meeting will be sort of anywhere between 5 and 10 working days long. So if you've got two of those for most of the working parties and 3 for working party 5D, which is the IMT working party, it's quite a lot of meeting time. So they do an awful lot of work.
I can imagine. So what about in Dubai? What about at the WRC? What's your role during the conference?
Well, during the conference, I'm a delegate. I will be representing the UK. I don't have a formal role because I'm a study group chair there. And in fact, what is happening, I'm coming to the end of my study group chair. Each study group chair is allowed 2 WRC cycles of chairing, and then essentially the rules say you have to step down. So this is I'm coming to the end of my second term. So the week before the WRC, there's a week-long meeting called the Radio Communications Assembly. That's the meeting at which the new chairs of the study groups, that, you know, for those study groups whose chairs having to step down, get elected. So I will be going out next week to Dubai for the Radio Communications Assembly meeting. And there I expect that will be my last formal activity as chair of the study group. So I will be presenting the results of the work that the study group has done during the study period. I may well be asked to chair various groups at the Radio Communications Assembly itself. But essentially at the end of that, my duties as study group 5 chair come to an end, and I hand the baton on to whoever else it is who's elected for the next period. And then when it comes to the WRC itself, I'm there representing the UK. I'm not there as a sort of a study group chair, because I won't be at that point. So I'll be taking part in the discussions and promoting the UK view on whatever issues that we think we need to push.
Right. So as a new, or if you are re-elected chair of a study group, do you then take any role at the conference, or?
Not necessarily. So if you're the newly elected chair of a study group, it's not automatic that you'll take a formal role at a World Radio Communications Conference. There are, you know, the structure and the working and the way that the conference works is established before the conference starts. So there's an informal discussions amongst the different regional groups across the world about how the conference should be structured and which individuals should be put forward to chair various subcommittees and committees. So it's possible that a study group chair might be put forward as a nominee to chair a committee at the WRC, but it's not a given, and mm-hmm. most times it tends to be other people that get the various committees at a conference rather than the study groups.
Who are these people then? The chancellors or the secretaries? I know they have quite some titles within the ITU.
Well, it's not the ITU functionaries, mm-hmm. so it will be representatives from different administrations. And what they try and do is get a regional balance of who's doing what. Obviously, it has its plenary with the chair, and the chair will be nominated from the host country. Under that, they will have typically 7 committees that have specific remits. And what they try and do is get a regional balance of representatives of the chairs who lead the individual committees under the plenary from the different regions, so that, for instance, Europe doesn't dominate or Africa doesn't dominate by having 2 or 3 chairs. So they try and even it out as much as they can. And those people will be from the different administrations within those regions.
Right. To have a sort of political balance, I guess.
Yeah, and of course it goes a bit deeper, because you have those 7 committees I've talked about, but for some of those committees, they then have a working groups and subgroups under them, and again the same principle about trying to get balance across the different regions of the people nominated to lead those applies. All of that is actually agreed, you know. So there's all this behind the scenes work in this, as I said, this informal committee that goes on prior to the WRC. But then the very start of the WRC, the head of delegations meeting, all of that is finally agreed. You know, we don't actually know. It's not set in stone until the very start of the conference. Though you've got a very good idea who's likely to be leading what, it's not absolutely agreed until that first head of delegation meeting.
That's quite a tight deadline to organize everything.
Well, I mean, there's lots of discussions going on behind the scenes. So,
yeah,
it's not like you go there and it's still all to be decided. But there have been occasions where you've had rival candidates for a particular position and it needs to be sorted at that meeting because they haven't been able to reach a compromise agreement beforehand. So, you know, hopefully, you know, virtually everything will be sorted before the start of this meeting. But, you know, there's a risk that certain things will need to be resolved right at the start of the conference in terms of how we manage it.
Understood. Okay. Well, let's talk about what will be discussed at the conference. So the most discussed IMT issues are the 6 GHz band and the lower UHF band. I've been covering those two items extensively over the last 2 years or so. But I really was interested in hearing your thoughts on them. Why are exactly these two issues so contested during this cycle?
Well, I think they're for different reasons, really. The upper 6 GHz band is, most of it is just being discussed for the ITU Region 1, which is Europe, Africa, the Arab states, and Russia that spreads into Asia. So that area, but it's contentious, A, because it's a lot of spectrum. There's 600, 700 megs worth of spectrum there in total. So that makes it, you know, it's a valuable prize. B, there are competing uses for it going forward. So you've got the IMT community on the one hand who want it for commercial mobile type services to supplement the capacity that they can deliver to people's mobile phones and such like. And then you've got the licensed exempt Wi-Fi community who want to use it for additional capacity on Wi-Fi. And traditionally it's difficult to get licensed, you know, high power services like IMT and low power licensed exempt services like Wi-Fi to share spectrum effectively. Certain decisions have already been made by certain countries around whether they want to use the band for Wi-Fi. So for instance, in North America, the United States has already made the band available for Wi-Fi. And that's influenced other people around the world. So there's a sort of growing set of countries where Wi-Fi is seen as the best way forward for that band. There are other countries and areas of the world where actually they want to promote the use of the band for IMT because they see it as a useful addition to the capacity that you can deliver for 5G type services. It's close enough to the core 5G band is used most areas of the world, the 3.5 GHz band, where you could essentially duplicate the coverage that you can get from a 3.5 GHz base station by using this particular band. So it adds, you know, it would add significant capacity potentially to mobile networks, you know, and given the increase in likely demand for mobile broadband services, it's seen as a very useful addition to 5G essentially. So with those two competing for the band and different areas of the world taking different views, it's colliding in the WRC. It's also contentious in that if we identify the band for IMT, for instance, high power mobile, then we have to look at the coexistence issues with the existing services that sit in the band. So that's things like the fixed service and the fixed satellite service. Particularly with the fixed satellite service, the aggregate impact of emissions from whole load of IMT base stations on the ground could swamp the signals, the receivers on the satellites. So we need to ensure, if we were to identify the band for IMT, we would protect those satellite receivers. Because if we don't, then you know, obviously they will, you know, they will see a lot of interference. So there's that's one issue, and you know, the studies have not been as conclusive on what you need to do to protect them as you might like. Some of the studies you know, are sort of showing that a relatively relaxed set of conditions might be sufficient. On the other hand, there are other studies put forward by other parties that show actually you need very stringent conditions, and getting the set of conditions right that would protect future FSS use is going to be one of the key issues to resolve if the band is going to be identified for IMT.
I understood that that's, as you said, that's one of the key issues, protecting those existing users. I had a look at the CPM report as well, and there are a few options, just like you mentioned.
Yeah, there's an EIRP mask in the vertical elevation plane to protect those satellites. So it essentially says, well, you can't transmit certain angles above the horizon. You mustn't transmit more than a certain amount of power. And so establishing what the appropriate set of power values at different angles above the horizon is the key thing that has been agreed as the best way to protect the FSS satellite receivers. But of course, the levels are the things that we've now got to fight over.
And I believe, if I'm wrong, please correct me. I believe that Europe, they have quite strict levels.
So if you look at the studies, there are a range. So there are some studies that lead to quite a relaxed mask, so quite a permissive mask. There are other, and those to characterise it, been those that have been pushed by the mobile community. On the other hand, the studies that have been pushed by the satellite community would want a very, very tight, quite restrictive mask to protect. If you look at where CPT in its ECP got to, I wouldn't say we were strict. We were probably more in the middle between the two extreme ends. So guess depends on your perspective if you think that's stringent or not, but it's a midway point, you know, it's relatively midway point between what the satellite community would want, the mobile community would want.
Mm-hmm. Understood. So another difficult agenda item is agenda item 1.5, which is the lower UHF band. So why is this such a hot topic at the moment?
Well, I mean, you know, it's the band is the whole of the UHF band. So 470 to 960 megahertz is a mixture of primarily broadcasting on the lower end and mobile on the upper part. And over the years, mobile has sort of been identified for more and more, so it's gone down the band, squeezing broadcasting into a smaller chunk at the bottom. It's very good for mobile because you can get very good coverage from those low frequencies. It's also very important for broadcasting. DTT services in the UK rely on that spectrum, and so there's a sort of balance to be had about how much of the band you want to retain for broadcasting, how much you would like to provide to mobile, because it can get, you know, very good coverage. So, you know, you can improve the coverage in more remote rural areas. It also allows you to get very deep into buildings that you wouldn't do with other frequency bands. And a lot of the issues about, well, how much is broadcasting used in certain countries? So the UK uses broadcasting a lot. It's very important to us. So it's important to ensure that we don't affect our broadcasting services. in other countries in the world, then terrestrial broadcasting is you know is either in decline or is you know has been phased out. A lot of countries might have already gone to IPTV, for instance. You don't need terrestrial broadcast spectrum for that. They would rather use that spectrum for mobile because it would give them better, you know, would be more valuable to them for that instance. And so there's a real tension there between the different uses. And therefore, you know, you've got to find a way that acknowledges that some countries broadcasting is not as relevant as it would be, whereas other countries broadcasting is still a very, very important way of delivering television to consumers. You've then got to balance the, you know, what do we do that doesn't risk the broadcasting use, which might, but at the same time, might also allow some countries to move faster on mobile use of the band if they need to. And you know, getting that balance right is really, you know, is really tricky, and that's why it's been so contentious. And likewise, the studies that have backed this up, it's similar to Upper Six. You know, depending on who's, you know, which study you look at, shows different possibilities.
I did some digging around in those coexistence studies as well. And they seem to be quite inconclusive. Do you think, so if a study like this is inconclusive, I think the UHF was even more inconclusive than the upper 6 gigahertz studies, or so I read in the CPM report. How does that translate in the conference? Is that used as an argument within these discussions, or does it have a big impact?
Well, it'll be used by the different parties in the way that suits them in terms of what their national position is. So for those countries that would want to preserve broadcasting, then they would obviously be, you know, relying on the studies that you know showed that sharing with mobile is more problematic, and vice versa. At the end of the day, though, that you know the reliance on the studies only goes so far, and you know you then have to look at the overall position and where the right balance, and it'll be a compromise. I'm sure it'll be a compromise, mm-hmm. and we'll just have to see, you know, how that plays out at the conference. It's going to be a lot of negotiation.
Bound to be long negotiations, yes. So are there any other agenda items within IMT-related issues?
There are the bands. So there's the 3.3.3 to 3.4 band in both Region 1 and Region 2, I think. And then there's 3.6 to 3.8 in Region 2. And then also in Region 2, there's 10 to 10.5 gigahertz. So there are other bands that are under consideration, and they will have their own issues to do with, you know, what the different parties want out of those. But certainly from a Region 1 Europe UK perspective, the upper 6 gigahertz band is the key for us. The others, you know, that we have a position less so.
What about agenda item 10, isn't it? Which is proposing IMT bands for WR27.
Yes, that will be also likely to be contentious. Whenever you're talking about specific bands, it's always contentious because there will be those people who want to protect their existing services in those bands, and there will be others who open them up for new services. There will be a debate on IMT between probably in frequencies between 7 to 15 gigahertz or specific frequency chunks in that band. But there's a lot of existing use in there. There's very important spectrum that's used for government for various issues, including defense. There's satellite use in those bands. There's passive science use in those bands, all of which are very key and protecting. And then there's the growing demand from the mobile community for ever more spectrum. So again, you know, there's going to be a discussion about, you know, are we going to have another agenda item for more IMT spectrum? A lot of people then wrap that up with the sort of the 6G label as well. So it's spectrum for 6G applications. And if there is, under what conditions? So you've got to protect, you know, I think there'll be a very strong push to ensure that the incumbent services are protected, and that if IMT does go into those bands, then we need to consider how it will share with those effectively. And so all of that needs to be discussed. You're right, it'll be another contentious issue just to decide what we want to study for the next 4 years, and then have another debate about it at the WRC in 27.
And on we go. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It sometimes feels like it's a never-ending cycle. I mean, but it's, I think the point is, it's getting harder and harder. I mean, we're working the spectrum much harder now than we were 20 years ago, and so it's becoming much more difficult to find additional spectrum bands for services like mobile. Previous years, it's more been a cycle of, we identify a band at the WRC, it's then cleared at a national level by administrations who want to use it for that purpose, and then they award the spectrum in a typically an auction. And so awarded as largely cleared of key of a lot of the services that were in there originally. So you would clear FlixLinks out, or you would, you know, you'd move broadcasting out of the way to make way for the new service. I think that's becoming much more difficult to do now, because those services have to go somewhere. It's very rare you can just not, you know, just take a band from them and then say, well, that's it, you don't have anywhere else to go. And so you have to have real sharing, you know, the equitable sharing, where the different uses actually have to cooperate a bit about where and how they use the spectrum. And I think that's the way we're going. Obviously, with the spectrum becoming more congested with new uses going into it, so you need to get much more cooperative ways of sharing spectrum than we would have done previously. And so that's going to affect how we consider what we do for things like new IMT bands in the future.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the importance of the studies and the study groups and the sharing studies that are being done throughout those 4 years, I guess the importance is just growing with spectrum getting scarcer and scarcer.
I think it's growing, but I also think it needs a sort of a mindset change from those parties who take part in those studies. It can be quite adversarial in terms of, this is my, I'm here already, I need to be protected from you, the newcomer, at all costs. And more to a scenario where you're actually thinking about how the sharing might work a bit more equitably between different services, so you facilitate the use rather than put in very stringent conditions to essentially, you know, constrain one party to the advantage of another. So I think the nature of the studies that will be needed under various agenda items going forward needs to subtly change, and it needs the different industry parties to be a bit more cooperative in how they think about things, and innovative new solutions to sharing need to be developed and embedded in those studies.
Right. So we've talked a lot about industry against industry, or spectrum user against spectrum user. But I guess it's the conference is member states getting together. And since the world is currently seeing several tense geopolitical situations, and in the end, WRC decisions do come down to politics. So do you see the current situation play into this conference? And if so, which topics do you think that will be most visible?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's the certain geopolitical situation at the moment. I think we hope is that WRCs are technical conferences. They try and find technical solutions to problems, and that's the goal of the people who go there. So I'm hoping that, you know, the conference itself can get on with its work without too much influence by that geopolitical solution. What I'm interested in is finding the right solutions, what needs to be done in terms of the conditions in the radio regulations and the various supporting resolutions. That's my goal. It's not, you know, it's not thinking about the those other issues. Now, you know, what might happen at the conference is, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly, I think the majority of the participants are there to sort of, you know, to find the technical solutions.
All right. Well, many thanks, Martin. I wish you the best of luck in Dubai. I believe that you're leaving soon.
Yep.
So thanks for today and thanks for this chat.
No, you're my pleasure and you're welcome.
If you're interested in reading more about the upcoming conference, do take a look at our website where you can find a recently updated research note on the subject. We always welcome your feedback and ideas for future episodes as well. Many thanks for listening to this edition of the Spectrum Policy Podcast, and remember to subscribe via your podcast provider so you don't miss future episodes.